Foundation of Entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2, streaming online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Britain is often described as a nation of gardeners. The passion for gardening began to take hold in the 18th century. Andrea Wolfe says it was a garden revolution with its roots in America. Andrea Wolfe tells the story of this revolution in The Brother Gardener's Botany Empire and the Birth of an Obsession. At the outset of this beautifully crafted story, Wolfe writes of leaving her German hometown and arriving in London a little more than a decade ago and being amazed at finding a nation obsessed with gardening, a pastime that involved just about everyone. If her friends were apartment dwellers, they loved spending their time off visiting the gardens of stately homes. If they had a piece of earth of their own, she reports that they felt, in her words, the thrill of digging and weeding could not be surpassed. Today, with her help, we'll explore this story of obsession and we'll hear stories of some of the people who planted its seeds, including Peter Collinson and John Bartram, Carl Linnaeus and Joseph Banks. Also appearing within the pages of this book, Ben Franklin and Captain William Bligh. Listeners, I invite you to join the conversation with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Andrea Wolfe, is a writer and commentator who trained as a design historian at London's College of Art. Her work has appeared in many British newspapers. She also appears regularly on BBC television and radio. In addition to being the author of The Brother Gardeners, she is the co-author of This Other Eden, Seven Great Gardens and 300 Years of English History. Her new book, The Brother Gardeners, is published by Knopf. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Andrea Wolfe, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I understand that you are in Monticello.
I am at the moment. I'm in a cottage, and if you hear any noise in the background, that's the gardener mowing the lawn, so I hope it's not going to be too noisy.
It's absolutely appropriate, is it not?
It is absolutely appropriate. Yeah. You're right.
So how is Monticello looking this Tuesday afternoon?
Oh, it's just so beautiful. They had a lot of rain, and now the sun is shining. Everything is just incredibly lush and beautiful. It's like the best time of the year, I think, to be here.
Oh, I'm green with envy. So how does gardening in England compare with what you saw around you in your German hometown?
Well, I had always, in Germany, and I don't want to offend any Germans, there are obviously amazing gardens in Germany, but just, to, you know, if we talk about it a little bit more generally, I had always associated gardening really with, you know, miles and miles of very straight hedges and perfectly cut lawn. And when I came to Britain, I couldn't quite believe how beautiful the gardens were, how everybody thought, you know, digging in the flower beds is like the greatest entertainment. And, you know, this kind of evidence the British obsession with guns kind of everywhere. So, for example, the British spend something like $6 billion a year on guns, which is almost as much as they spent last year on their military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm. So they do, you know, they do spend a lot of money and a lot of time on gardening. While I have not a single German friend who's an obsessive gardener, while I have lots and lots of obsessive gardeners, friends in Britain.
Yeah. Now, how does gardening in Britain compare with that in the United States? We're a little nutty about it, too.
Well, that's a really unfair question now, isn't it? well, you know, considering the fact that I'm right now in one of the most beautiful gardens in the country, I think it compares very well, actually. What I've noticed just by driving through the States is that you see, because you have so much more land, so the gardens are much, much larger. So you see, compared to all the, you know, kind of suburban gardens I know from Britain, which are small, which are walled, which are more like a cottage garden. The American garden seems larger, more lawn, slightly emptier maybe.
So how long was it after arriving in England that you found yourself with a garden and you were hooked?
Well, it's kind of, you know, it went pretty quickly, I have to say, because in London, you tend to, even if you rent a flat, it normally comes with a little bit of the backyard. So even when I didn't really want to garden, I had all my, you know, friends coming in saying, oh, you've got to do something here, or they would bring cuttings. And so I started gardening. But it was actually, I'm more of a historian in this respect also, so it was more that I was getting really interested in the stories behind the plants. So once you kind of find out that a lot of these plants are named after plant hunters, for example, you start thinking about their stories, how these plants arrived. When I learned, for example, that Britain only has 4 native evergreens, you suddenly, you know, you look around in the parkland and you suddenly realize that what I thought was the archetypal English parkland was actually made up of foreign introductions, and many of them were American introductions, actually.
Yeah. So in the 17th century, at the end of the 17th century, what did a typical English garden look like?
Well, a typical English garden at the end of the 17th century would be a garden very much ruled by geometry and straight lines. So you would have a garden which had straight paths, where you would have topiary, you would have hedges which were literally clipped into green walls. You'd see a garden in which no flower head, no branch was allowed to grow unruly. So it kind of looked very much almost as if the gardener had imposed a corset upon nature.
It seems to me that we have an 18th century gardener to thank for this book that you've written. His name, Philip Miller. Who was he?
Philip Miller was the head gardener of the Chelsea Physic Garden, which was a botanic garden in the city of London, or just outside London then. Today it's in the city of London. And he arrived there in the early 1720s. And he kind of turned it into the most thriving botanical collection in England. And but he did something really remarkable. He wrote a book which was called The Gardener's Dictionary, which was first published in 1731. And it was the first systematic manual on practical gardening. What he did is he listed alphabetically all the plants which were in cultivation in Britain. And under each entry, he gave information on, you know, how to nurture and cultivate them, which doesn't sound very revolutionary to us because that's how plant dictionaries are set up. But that was the first of its kind, so it's the mother of all plant dictionaries. And for the first time, he gave British gardeners professional knowledge. So he turned the British in almost into a nation of amateur gardeners because he gave them the knowledge they needed, which was before not available to them.
Yeah, it's also interesting to realize that after that first edition, he published another one in 1735, and it was smaller and less expensive. So this really helped make England a place of gardens that were not just for the wealthy.
Absolutely. So what he did is he published, I mean, there were actually within his lifetime, he published 8 editions of the big book. And then he also published, I think, 12 editions of the small one, which was a pocket-sized book, which basically you could just have in your potting shed, you could have in the, you know, in the pockets of your coat. So it was very cheap, but it was also incredibly practical because you could take it with you in the garden.
Yeah. And contemporary to him was Carl Linnaeus. Did they know of one another?
Yes, they did. They actually didn't like each other at all. Carl Linnaeus was a Swedish botanist, and he came up with 2 things. He came up with a new naming system and a new classification system of plants. And we can talk about that later if you want to. But what he did is he wanted to convince English gardeners and botanists to use it because they were the kind of leading gardening nation in the 18th century. So he came to London in 1736 and actually went to the Chelsea Physic Garden. He went to see Miller. He spent 4 days there, and they didn't get on at all. So Miller, for example, got very upset that Linnaeus was actually not really interested in living plants. You know, Linnaeus was kind of looking through Miller's herbarium and the kind of the dried plants. And Linnaeus was really upset because Miller would not use his new systems in the next edition of his dictionary. So they had a little bit of a problematic relationship, those two.
Yeah. Although I think Philip Miller is probably a pretty good judge of character. What do you think?
Well, I think, yes, because Linnaeus was quite a cantankerous man. And he was incredibly arrogant. I mean, he was a genius botanist. So
sure, certainly.
Get that. Right, but he called himself rather modestly the Prince of Botanists. So he was, you know, he was rather full of himself, that man. And he very much liked to show off and tell other botanists that he was better than they were.
Yeah. So he, Linnaeus, to his credit, pioneered a system of plant classification, and also he standardized plant names. So we really owe him a lot.
Yes, I mean, so his classification system is not in use anymore, but his naming system is the international standard of plant names. Which, what he did is, until he came up with his system, plant names could be incredibly long. He said they could be 1 foot long, which is a little bit exaggerated, but a plant name had to include the description of a plant, and he came up with this very simple and straightforward solution where he gave every plant a 2-word name, almost like a first name and a surname, such as, for example, Magnolia grandiflora. So Magnolia is the name of the genus, which is like the surname. Grandiflora is like your first name, so that signifies the species. And because of that, I can buy the same plant, say, in America to Germany and in London, because the Latin name will be the same everywhere in this world.
Mm. The first part of the book really belongs to an Englishman by the name of Peter Collinson and an American by the name of John Bartram. Collinson was a London merchant with a cottage in a village, and he was a religious man who dressed quite plainly, but when it came to his garden, it must have been spectacular.
Yes, Peter Collinson, like John Bartram, was a Quaker, and so he dressed very plainly. And plants, in a way, was the only thing kind of ornamental allowed to him. So he was a passionate plant collector, and his garden was one of the best private plant collections in the country. And which became incredible once he was introduced to the American farmer John Bartram, because John Bartram then would send him every species he could get from America.
And tell us a little bit about Bartram. He's a fascinating figure.
Well, John Bartram, I have to say, of all the 6 men in my book, he is the one I adore the most. He is a farmer. He lived just outside Philadelphia, and he sent, from 1734, for 40 years, he sent every year dozens and dozens of seed boxes from Philadelphia to London, where Collinson would then distribute them. And he almost single-handedly changed the English landscape. And a lot of the landscape we see today in England, the parkland, the English garden, or what we associate with as the English garden, is based on species that John Bartram introduced. All the kind of, you know, trees, flowering shrubs, evergreens, all came from his plant hunting explorations in the colonies, and he sent it over to Peter Collinson. And they have this wonderful relationship, these two men, because they actually never meet, but they write letters over 40 years.
Mm.
And they kind of change from being very unequal to becoming very, very close friends. And it's just wonderful to kind of follow that development through their letters.
Yeah. Do all those letters survive?
Many survive because Collinson was a merchant. He kind of knew how many of these letters get lost. And because they were constantly referring to certain plants they had sent, Collinson had asked Bartram to take a copy of every letter he would send. So each man, whenever they wrote a letter, they would take a copy. So the chances that one of those two letters survived was quite good. So yes, so there are hundreds of letters now where you can follow their relationship. And they kind of bicker, and they have these kind of little petty arguments which can take years because the letters take so long to cross the oceans. It's just wonderful.
Yeah. Boy, you must have been quite the happy historian to come across these letters.
Yeah, I mean, they are, Collinson and Bartram are kind of known side figures in garden history, but never, you know, no one has kind of fully kind of addressed their relationship in a full book, I think. And I think they're just such a interesting, they're just interesting men, because what they did is in the 18th century, they managed to create a global network, really, which changed our landscape, which I think is just extraordinary how they did that. You know, if you consider how difficult it was to transport the plants, they never met, how difficult it was to just communicate with each other.
Yeah. Early on in the book, you said the transformation of the landscape also changed England in that it moved England out into the world. Would you talk about that?
I think what I mean with that is actually that the changing of the English landscape kind of goes in tandem with the expanding empire.
Mm.
So if you look at the 17th century, the leading gardening nation in the 17th century are really the Dutch, and they had a very big empire then. And then in the 18th century, the English catch up, and the empire kind of allows them this access to all these new countries. And, you know, the merchants who go into these new countries bring in new plants. At the same time, obviously, English plants get sent to the new colonies. So, for example, John Bartram, in the beginning of his friendship with Peter Collinson, he's incredibly keen to get European plants because they are like, you know, they're almost like a status symbol here in the colonies.
Hmm. The Royal Society in Britain was founded in the latter half of the 17th century. What role did a burgeoning scientific curiosity play in this revolution, this gardening revolution?
I think it's incredibly important because, in a way, if you look at Britain and the scientific revolution, unlike, say, for example, the Germans, who in the 17th century very much kind of based this on abstract mathematical thoughts, in England, science was very much based on observations and experiments rather than abstract thought. So what they did is they applied science to daily life almost. And one of the sciences that really profited from this was horticulture, because they, for example, understood that plants reproduced sexually, which was a revolutionary thought. And because they understood that, they could, for example, create hybrids. So the understanding of plant science was incredibly important for practical gardening.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer and commentator Andrea Wolf. She is the author most recently of The Brother Gardeners, Botany Empire and the Birth of an Obsession. Britain is often described as a nation of gardeners. The passion for gardening began to take hold in the 18th century. Our guest says it was a garden revolution with its roots in America, thanks to one John Bartram and others. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener who's joining us on line one from Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The stories that you're relating about large amounts of seeds and plants being shipped back to England from America and other places makes me wonder, it sounds like an invitation to invasion by exotic plants. When I think that something as seemingly innocuous to us as cabbage caused devastation in Argentina, it seems to me that with all these plants coming in and being widely planted, that the native biota of England must have had a hard time. I was wondering what we know about that.
Well, I can tell you one thing. As far as I know, there has not been a single plant that was introduced by John Bartram to England that has become invasive. But the other way around. So Bartram, for example, writes to Collinson. I can't recall the name of the plant now, but it was an annual flower which Collinson had in his flower beds in his garden, and Bartram was complaining that it was going complete, you know, riot in his garden. And there's a letter back from Collinson saying, "I don't understand. It's, you know, a really nice and neat little flower in my flower bed." So yes, you're absolutely right. There was the risk of invasive species. I think at that time, Collinson also sends from China, which goes via England, the paper mulberry to the United States, which becomes very invasive here. So it is a problem, absolutely.
Okay, but as far as you know, then there wasn't anything that happened of this nature in England that caused loss of native species in England.
I mean, there are lots and lots of invasive species in England. So, for example, we have Japanese knotweed. We have a particular species of rhododendron, which is causing huge, huge problems. But nothing that was introduced by John Bartram did actually become an invasive species.
That's very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Did Bartram, would he have, was this serendipitous that he didn't put anything on a boat to Britain that would cause a problem, or did he know something?
No, I think that's just sheer luck.
Basically. Sheer luck. Okay.
I mean, he was aware of that there could be a problem like invasive species,
uh-huh.
but they were not that. I mean, the excitement of receiving a new plant was far too big to not take that risk, basically.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Belgium, Illinois, line four. Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon to you all. My question is going to be a little off your subject, and maybe you can help me. Definitely has to do with your gardens, though. In life, I deal with wood a lot, and my hobby is to turn things a lot. And a lot of British turners who are ornamental turners, turn small ornamental objects, really like a particular type of woody plant that it grows in English gardens. It's called the laburnum. Have you ever
yep.
heard of that one?
Yep.
I'm looking for laburnum. I would love to get some. If we could find somebody here in the Midwest that would have it, I'd be more than glad to go get it. And that was what I was getting at. Can you tell me anything about the plant other than it has beautiful chocolate brown wood with a nice grain in it?
No, I can't. I'm really sorry.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. What an interesting question.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Andrea Wolf, the author of The Brother Gardeners, Botany Empire and the Birth of an Obsession. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800 1-800-222-9455. Also, in the first half of the book, we run into a friend of Peter Collinson, who's also a really nice part of the story, Robert James, and you'll have to correct me if I'm mispronouncing his last name. Is it Peter or Petre?
I think it's Petra, but...
Petra, okay.
You know, one of those things, nobody really knows because names can be pronounced as the family kind of likes.
Sure.
But I call him Lord Petra.
Petra. What's his role in the story of the transformation of the English Garden?
Lord Petra is one of those forgotten figures in garden history, although his contemporaries hailed him as the most innovative gardener of his age. He was a very, very wealthy aristocratic landowner, as passionate as Collinson about plants, but much wealthier. And he had a huge estate called Thorndon in Sussex, which was 1,000 acres, just the parkland. And what he did is he was one of the first subscribers to Bartram's boxes, because Bartram would sell his boxes for 5 guineas a year. You get like a huge box full of seeds. And Petra ordered not just one box, he ordered dozens and dozens. So he did everything on an incredibly large scale. He planted so many foreign species that at some stage there were 200,000 foreign plants growing in his greenhouses and in his parkland. And what he did is he used Bartram's variety of American species, as Collinson calls it, as living pencils. So he's, instead of imposing patterns through parterres and topiary onto nature, he's beginning to use nature itself as kind of as patterns or as varieties. So he's using the shape of different trees. He's contrasting different barks, you know, like peeling and white and smooth kind of against each other. So he's literally painting with these new trees which are and shrubs which are coming in from America. And through that, he is loosening up that kind of very formal garden that existed until then. And everything becomes much more kind of, you know, natural, really.
Mm. What are his writings like?
Sorry?
What are his writings like?
Petra, his writing?
Yeah, I mean, he called his circle of gardening enthusiasts my brother gardeners.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm wondering if he wrote letters or if he had journals, diaries, or anything like that.
He has, there are very few letters left by him. Quite a few of them, which are actually to Collinson and also to another landowner called the Duke of Richmond, and to Miller, and he calls them his brother gardeners, which is where the title of the book comes from. Because, and I think that's the lovely thing about this story of these men, is that this passion and love for gardening absolutely transcends the idea of social class, of religion, and even nationality. So Lord Petre, who was a Catholic, for example, he was a very wealthy Catholic. Collinson is a Quaker. Philip Miller is just a head gardener. So all these men suddenly are working together, are discussing their ideas together, and are sharing their love for garden.
Hmm. Did women garden?
Women did garden. And I often get asked, like, why,
sure.
why is it the story of six men and not women? And one of the reasons is that... if women gardened, very often they didn't leave records. So it's quite difficult as a historian to kind of capture that. Women become much more prominent in the 19th century because botany in the beginning of the 19th century becomes the first science which is open to women, because it is about pretty plants rather than explosive chemicals. So the women come a little bit later. There are women collectors in the 18th century. There's, for example, one, the Duchess of Portland. But again, they are not so much connected within this kind of broad network. And I was interested much more in the network rather than in the story of an individual.
Yeah. In the book, though, you do tell us about the fashion, how fashion was affected by this interest in horticulture. By the mid-18th century, there, earlier in the story, you describe a gown worn by the Duchess of Queensbury. And then also there, the craze for flowers, you report, was also manifested in other facets of daily life. Fabrics were printed with flowers and all kinds of parlor games.
There were botanical carts, for example, where you could learn while you play. I think one of the funniest or nicest kind of things of this is the fashion of the flowers in wigs. So if you imagine Marie Antoinette, the French queen, she had always these enormous wigs. They were so tall that she had to kneel in her carriage. And they became very fashionable in England, too. And Marie Antoinette, for example, she would wear, when the Americans declared independence, she would wear like an American ship in her wig as a sign of her appreciation of what was going on. But in England, they would have literally gardens in their wigs. And there's a wonderful, I found a wonderful diary entry where someone describes, I think it says, like, I saw 11 damsels, and between them they had an acre and a half of strawberry and tulip beds on their head. And they're wonderful caricatures of from the 18th century, where you can see literally these wigs with temples and, you know, gardeners and greenhouses. Everything is like a mini tableau. It's all kind of set in the wig.
Yeah, and you have a caricature in the book, a satire on flower and gardening fashions in this woman's garden hair, head, wig. It oh my goodness, it's probably taller than she is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and are those potatoes that she's sprouting alongside there?
No, like, funnily, lots of people ask me if they have bread. They look a bit like baguette, but it's actually like curls, which are kind of, you know, fixed with flour, actually, and some kind of glue. I mean, the whole thing is just such an artificial structure. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it was the perfect canvas, almost, to put flowers on there. But, you know, as you said earlier, you'd see flowers on, you know, on dresses. And lots of tourists who came to London were just amazed to see. I mean, they would report on the gardens. They'd write home, you know, French or German tourists in the 18th century. They would write home and say, like, it's just so wonderful, the gardens here, and it's full of exotic plants, and the English are all completely mad about it. And then later, when the English garden became fashionable in Europe, European gardeners would send their gardeners to England to learn, you know, the kind of craft of gardening.
Yeah. There are some beautiful plates of drawings of plants in your book. Who would have seen these, and what effect would they have had on people?
But there are some, the earlier botanical drawings, which we included in the book, are by a man called Mark Catesby, who came in the very early 18th century to America, to the colonies. And he was not so much collecting plants like Bartram. What he did is he was painting them. And he brought them back and then got them engraved and hand-colored them and sold them to, for example, people like Collinson and Miller. And these plant catalogs almost function like mail-order catalogs, because the English gardeners had never seen something like this. And a lot of these, as you will see in the book, a lot of these are flowering trees and flowering shrubs, such as the fringe tree or calicarpa or the tulip poplar. So the English gardeners just couldn't get enough of that. And then seeing these beautiful botanical drawings, which, you know, had such vibrant colors, they then wanted to have them in their garden. So Collinson, for example, sent Bartram a copy of these drawings so that he could literally say, you know, take plate 17 of Catesby's drawings and I want that plant. So then Bartram could go and find it somewhere in the colonies. And then later in the 19th century, in the 18th century, sorry, you would have in, I think in the 1790s, you have the first botanical magazine where you actually, and that's how you can see how much the English have changed, because by the end of the 18th century, there are lots of people who want to have these, and they're much, much cheaper, and it becomes very much a kind of middle-class hobby.
Yeah. What were the first gardening magazines like?
Well, the first gardening magazines were basically a collection of botanical drawings, in one volume, in one number, you'd get like 10, I think. That was the botanical magazine, which was the first one. You'd get 10 drawings and printed drawings, and then you would have a page or two of text which would explain the botanical details of this plant, but not so much how to actually grow it. You would then have to go and buy something like Philip Miller's dictionary and look up how to actually nurture and grow this plant.
Let's take another call. A listener in Robinson, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have one quibble to make with English gardeners. We are all enormously indebted to them, all the way from Vita Sackville West back to Culpeper. But something that you say drives me right up the wall. I believe I heard you mention papaver a few minutes ago, a poppy. The Latin would be papaver, but yet you said calicarpa, which is perfect Latin pronunciation. I used to think it was jocular that English schoolboys spoke of Peter and Mater, but this proves that mispronunciation still exists in the binomial system in the English language. It's good enough if you go to a nursery in England and order a papaver, but if you go to France or Spain or Germany, they're not going to pronounce that word that way. Do you not agree?
I didn't understand the poppy bit. I can't remember saying poppy, actually.
You didn't say poppy. You said papaver. P-A-P-A-V-E-R.
I didn't, but I probably would have, yes.
Okay.
So what you're trying to say is that I actually can't go to a nursery in Germany, in France, or in England and order it by the Latin name.
No, you would order it by the Latin name if you were sending in a written order. But if you spoke to the nurseryman in Latin-based...
Yeah, you're right. They would not... But what we could do then is, for example, is we could look it up in a plant dictionary. Just to give you an example, for example, my book has come out in England and also in America, and the only thing we had to change were some of the common names of the plants, because they're different in the UK.
Oh, well, of course, that goes without saying.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention this little thing of the English-Latin pronunciation of the binomials that rubs me the wrong way every time I hear it. Otherwise, I am enjoying this program, and thank you for your knowledge.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening this afternoon and taking the time to join us this afternoon. Boy, the time is just running by so quickly. We have to talk about Joseph Banks before time is out. This was also a time of exploration. Enter Joseph Banks. Tell us about this wealthy adventurer and his achievements and his contributions to gardening.
Well, Joseph Banks is an extraordinary character because he was an incredibly wealthy landowner, and he could have chosen to have a very comfortable life. And like so many other wealthy plant collectors, he could have sent someone out for him to take the risk and the danger. But what he did is he joined Captain Cook on the Endeavour and circumnavigated the globe. And he left England in 1768, and he came back 3 years later on his way. he had been to Rio de Janeiro, Tahiti, New Zealand, and they had also landed at a place where no white man had ever been, the east coast of Australia, where he had seen so many plants he could just not imagine, that they called actually the first place, the place of their first landfall, Botany Bay, because there were so many plants there. And when he came back to England, he became the president of the Royal Society, the nominal director of the Royal Botanic Garden at Kew. And what he did is he believed that plants could bring economic profit to the country. And the idea was to, or the first step in this endeavor for him was to turn Kew Gardens into an engine of colonial growth and into a storehouse of the empire. So what he did is he sent out plant collectors across the globe and asked them to send plants back to Kew, where they could be tested and propagated and cultivated and experimented, and then they would be sent to other colonies. So it was, for example, his idea to send Chinese tea plants to India to break the Chinese tea monopoly, although it didn't work when he tried this. But he also had the idea to send breadfruit trees from the East Indies to the West Indies, where he thought they would make good food for the slave population on the sugar plantation.
Mm. Here we've talked a little bit about, or you've touched on, colonial growth and empire. Also, there were a number of political and political tensions and wars during this period of time. In 1740, I'll just mention a couple of these. 1740, Britain drawn into a war in Europe. In 1756, tensions flare with the French over power in America. And then, of course, relations between England and the American colonies deteriorate, and we have a revolution. How did these political developments, conflicts, and wars affect the exchange of plants?
Well, the main problem really was that ships would be captured, and one of the first cargoes which would go overboard were the plants, because they were kind of considered as the most unimportant. Also, at certain times with certain wars, you know, American ships were not allowed to arrive in British ports, for example. So what these men did, and I think that's the extraordinary thing, which, you know, touches again this idea that this love for plants transcends, you know, religion and political issues, that you have, for example, Collinson writing to his French friend saying, well, we can't accept at the moment American ships, but please, you know, send them to, can Bartram send them to Paris and then send them from there to England? So, you, for example, you have Benjamin Franklin when he is in Paris during the War of Independence. He actually takes over some of the plant distribution system for Bartram, and he then sends the boxes to England.
Hmm. We have to wrap up here. We've got a minute or two left. I've got a couple of questions left, I guess. But first of all, I'm assuming that your first book, which you co-authored with another writer, This Other Eden, Seven Great Gardens and 300 Years of English History, led you to the Brother Gardeners.
Yes.
And then I'm wondering, where will the Brother Gardeners lead you?
The Brother Gardeners are leading me to where I am now, which is Monticello, because I'm through Bartram. What I realized is that, you know, people like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington would buy their plants in John Bartram's nursery, because what's happening is that by the end of the 18th century, American gardeners suddenly, slowly, not suddenly, realized that their own native species are actually rather special, because you have, for example, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams go on a garden tour in England, and they realize that these gardens are full of American trees. So the next project is really looking at American gardens. So that's, you know, so John Bartram, in a way, is the link to the next book.
Yeah, so there you are in Monticello.
Yep.
Mount Vernon's got to be on the list somewhere.
I've been in Mount Vernon.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a wonderful time there last autumn.
Well, we look forward to the next book.
It'll be a while.
Okay. Well, I'm sure it'll be worth the wait. This is a lovely book, The Brother Gardeners.
Thank you.
Andrea Wolf has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon magazine. She is the author most recently of The Brother Gardeners, Botany Empire, and The Birth of an Obsession. The book is published by Alfred A. Knopf. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Celeste. Taking a look at those numbers as they settled in Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon. Futures finished the day like this in Chicago from the wheat pit. After this morning's USDA reports, wheat futures, one moment please, while they'll come up in front of me, I hope. Yeah, there they are. The wheat numbers finished like this in the nearby contract. That May futures a settlement price 2 cents higher for the day. The high price at 584.5, the low at 569.5, a settlement price at 582.5 up to July. 2 cents higher, 597.5 the high, the low at 79.25. Settlement price at 592.75 up to in September, 623.25 the high, the low at 605.75. Settlement price at 619.5 up 2.5 cents on the afternoon. Futures from the corn pit nearby May contract up 6 cents today. 423.25 the high, the low at 13, settled at 419.5 up 6. July futures 431.75 the high, the low at 420, settled at 427.5 up 6.25. And September 439.5 the high, the low at 28.75, settlement price at 436.25 up 6.75. December futures 450.25 the high, the low at 39.25. Settlement price at $4.48, up 7.75. The March contract in the corn pit, 460.75. The high, the low at $4.50.5. Settlement price at 458.75, up 8. From the oat pit nearby May contract gained 3 cents to settle at 231.5. And July futures at 235.5 in the oats, up 3 as well. Soy complex now, May beans, $11.39, the high, the low at 11.15, settled 11.37.5, up 7.5, July 11.27.5, the high, the low at $11.02, settlement price at 11.17.5, up 1.5. August contract, $10.87.25, the high, low at 10.64, settlement price at $10.75, down a penny, and September futures, 10.31.75, the high, the low at 17.25. Settlement price at $10.23.5, a fairly narrow trading range there, a penny and a half lower. That in the September contract, November futures, $9.95.75, the high ranging to a low at $9.78, settled not too far above that at $9.79.5, down 3.5. January soybeans for next year at $9.98 on the top, the bottom at $82, settlement price at $9.83.75. Down 3 cents. May bean meal futures today, 366.50, top a bottom at 360.40. Settlement price at 366.20. They were up $3.80. July bean meal, 347.40. The high, the low at $340.50. Settlement price at 346.70, up 230. And the May bean oil, 39.90. The high, the low at 39.23. Settlement price 39.39, up 11 on the afternoon. July bean oil futures, 40.20, the high, the low at 39.28, settlement price at 39.68, up 10. During the closing market report this afternoon, we'll go through all the USDA numbers that were released this morning from Washington, D.C. after a lockup overnight, and yesterday's crop progress report as well. Big numbers to report there, all coming out of the Eastern Corn Belt, where in Illinois, the number two producing state in the nation for corn, just 10% planted. They doubled the score from last week, but way, way, way behind still, something like 3 weeks behind in their planting progress for corn. So we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana, during the closing market report about that. And we'll hear a bit more about the agricultural energy markets when we talk with Stephen Platt. Don Day will be with us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. It's not pretty for the planting season right on, well, through the next 10 days or so. You'll hear more at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. Recapping what happened in Chicago, the numbers from the wheat pit were about 2 cents higher. Corn futures were up 6 in the nearby contract. December up 7.75 on out, anywhere between 2 and 7 cents higher. And the soy complex was mixed. The two nearby contracts were up 7 and 1.5, and then the deferreds were about a penny to 3 cents lower. We'll have more when I return at 6 after the hour of 2. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Now we turn our attention to the livestock contracts. June live cattle, the high today 83.90, the low 83.10, the settlement 83.20, down 7.5. August 84.40, the high 83.45, the low 83.57.5, the settlement, that down 32.5. October 89.30, the high, the low 88.50, the settlement 88.70, that unchanged. December 91.32.5, the high 90.60, the low 90.90, the settlement, that up 7.5. The feeder cattle finished lower on the day today. May 99.70, the high 99.15, the low 99.32.5, the settlement, that down 22.5. August 101.87.5, the high 101.25, the low 101.45, the settlement, that down 15. September 101.85, the high 101.20, the low 101.55, the settlement, that down 32.5. October 102.20, the high 101.60, the low 102.05, the settlement, that down 70. May lean hog 61.80, the high 61.50, the low 61.75, the settlement, that up 65. June 69.22.5, the high 68.60, the low, the settlement 68.92.5, that up 115. July 70.70, the high 70.15, the low 70.60, the settlement, that up 85. August 71.40, the high, the low 70.80, the settlement 70.85, that up 60. July pork bellies 80.40, the high 78.55, the low, the settlement 78.55, that down 50. The Dow is currently up 40 points at 84.59. The NASDAQ is off 13 at 17.19. The S&P 500 up a fraction at 9.10. Nearby crude up 35 in New York, trading at 58.73 a barrel. It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, Illinois Public Media. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frain. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in western Illinois, partly to mostly sunny, elsewhere sunny, highs ranging from 67 in northeastern Indiana to 75 in the far south. Tonight in Illinois, becoming cloudy with showers and thunderstorms moving in from west to east. In Indiana tonight, increasing cloudiness, showers and thunderstorms arriving toward daybreak. Lows ranging from 47 in northeastern Indiana to around 60 in far southern Illinois. The outlook for tomorrow: partly to mostly cloudy, windy and warmer with periods of rain and thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms will contain heavy rainfall and some will become severe with large hail, damaging winds, possibly tornadoes, especially across central Illinois during the afternoon and evening. Highs ranging from 68 in northeastern Indiana to 81 in far southern Illinois. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, sunny, the high in the low 70s. Tonight, becoming cloudy with showers and thunderstorms arriving after midnight, the low 55. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy and windy with occasional showers and thunderstorms. Some strong storms are possible during the late afternoon tomorrow in Champaign-Urbana, the high 77. The wind tomorrow from the south at 20 to 30 miles per hour with higher gusts. Tomorrow night, cloudy with periods of rain and thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may be severe, the low 55. The outlook for Thursday in Champaign-Urbana, partly to mostly sunny with a high of 72. More on the weather as part of the closing market report with Todd Gleason. That follows news from NPR. Coming up later this afternoon on The World from PRI, an armed religious group is using extortion and murder to gain political power in central Kenya.